chant just now, the quail's protection. There's a story behind it. They say the Buddha was walking through some fields one day, and he stopped at a point and smiled. Ananda saw the smile, and he knew that Buddhas don't smile without a reason. So he asked him. And the story goes that the Buddha said in a previous lifetime, he was born as a quail, lived in that field. One day when he was still a baby quail, his parents were off someplace else looking for food, and a huge fire came sweeping through the field. And the quail knew he had no other protection, so he made a vow of truth. In his case, the vow of truth was simply this: my parents are gone. My wings are undeveloped. My feet are undeveloped. Go away, fire. And the fire avoided the spot where he was. What's interesting about the story is what it says about the power of truth. In the quail's case, it was simply a statement of a true fact that kept the fire away. But in our meditation, truth means something more. That you're really very honest with yourself about what you're doing. Because otherwise you have no protection in the meditation. You hear instructions, and how do you know that the instructions are true? You hear that the Buddha said X, Y, or Z, and how do you know it was X, Y, or Z? Or even if he did say X, Y, or Z, was it applicable to where you are right now? As that other chant said just now, the world has no protector. There's no one in charge. There's no one you can run to say, is this true? Is this not true? The only thing you can rely on is your own truth. This doesn't mean just your subjective idea of what you would like to be true, but what's actually working in terms of cause and effect in your practice. This is the one quality that carries you through in all circumstances. You look at the history of the forest tradition. It's basically a bunch of peasant sons. And the authority in those days resided in Bangkok. All the pronouncements about what the Buddha taught. Not only that, but as time went on, there came the question, what did the Buddha teach that was relevant to our time? And pronouncements were coming out that did not jibe with what was taught from the previous generation. Now, a lot of people simply gave in. Whatever the line was from Bangkok, that was the line that they espoused. But the forest tradition didn't go in that direction. They stuck first by what they knew of the Dhamma and Vinaya, and even that they tested. This is a principle that Ajahn Mun trained in all of his students. One was the confidence that they could actually do the practice and figure out what was genuine Dhamma from what was not. But it depended on their own truthfulness, their own honesty. Really looking at what they were doing, really looking at the results. Testing themselves. If you say you're without passion, well, go out into the forest and see how long your mind can last. If you say you're without fear, well, again, go into the forest and see what happens when you hear strange noises in the night. And it's through testing yourself against these things that you began to get a strong sense of what you could rely on and what you couldn't. And in meeting, the various forest giants that I did know, there was this quality they all had in common. Their personalities were very different. Some were very calm. Some were more fiery. But they all had this attitude of, one, healthy skepticism to things they heard and saw outside. And two, that you had this very strong sense about them. They're very solid and reliable. This is a quality that they developed over time. Through their practice, kept getting tested again and again. This is something they really need, especially given that they didn't stay around with Ajahn Mun all the time. They would stay a little while, and then he'd send them off to a cave or to a mountain or to a forest area to learn to test themselves on their own. And it's through having tested what they had learned through their practice that they came back, and they were not fazed by what was coming out of Bangkok, what the scholars were telling them. So all of us in our practice should try to develop this same quality as well, because there are so many versions out there of what the Buddha taught. People speaking with a lot of confidence that this must be the way it is. One of the discoveries of the Forest Ajahns was that there was no clear line separating samatha practice from vipassana, or jhana practice from insight practice. The two shaded together. Now the line coming out of Bangkok was they were two very different things. And it wasn't just coming out of Bangkok, this was coming from a long commentarial tradition. And we can look now at the canon, which in those days wasn't very much available in Thai, and see that the Forest Ajahns were onto something. When the Buddha taught mindfulness and jhana, he didn't really separate the two drastically. He talked about his basic formula in mindfulness practice, and then he talked about developing it as a form of jhana. Focus on the body in and of itself, ardent and alert and mindful, putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. And that's the formula for mindfulness. Then he would say, first you develop this concentration with directed thought and evaluation. That's a jhana practice. Then without directed thought and evaluation, with enjoyment, with equanimity. In other words, you take it through all the four jhanas. The basic theme of concentration practice is, or one of the basic themes of the concentration practice is just this, the establishing of mindfulness. There are lots of passages you can cite. Showed that the Buddha put the two practices together. Same with developing insight. You start with strong concentration, and you develop insight by looking into the concentrated state, analyzing it in terms of the five aggregates, or simply the fact that it's constructed, fabricated. But even to get into that concentrated state, he also says that you need some, not only some tranquility, but also some insight. If you don't understand the workings of your mind, it's hard for it to settle down. So these two sides of meditation practice work together. Now, why is this important? Well, for one thing, when you are allowed to mix mindfulness with concentration, or tranquility with insight, it broadens your range of tools. If you're doing just, say, what is said to be a vipassana practice, or just watching and not reacting to anything, it really ties your hands. And the question is, if you're just watching what passes, 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 how are you going to understand cause and effect? Scientists don't just sit around watching what passes by, they interfere with the process. They try to direct it in a certain way, and then watch what happens as a result. Then they change the parameters of their experiment to see what result that has. It's through interfering that you learn things. And it's the same with the mind. We're interfering with the mind here. We're trying to get a good, solid state of concentration going, calm, easeful. And we learn about the mind by seeing what works and what doesn't work. That's insight right there. And if things aren't going well, you have the freedom to change them. After all, who's going to sit here and watch over you, telling you what you can and can't do while you meditate? What this also does, by putting the two practices together, or the two sides of the practices together, means that you have to learn how to monitor what you're doing. It's not simply a matter of learning the instructions and then doing what you're told without reflecting on what you're doing, without reflecting on the results. Or it's not a matter of taking the results to your teacher and have him say, oh yes, that's the first jhana, or that's the first insight, or whatever. Because again, what does the teacher know? How do you know what the teacher knows? You've got to look at the results in your own mind. So what this does, it focuses you on that issue of where is there stress right now? Where can this, what's causing the stress? This is called appropriate attention, seeing things in these terms. And this is the faculty, this is the quality, the Buddha said, is most important in gaining awakening. And this is how you gain insight, is by looking at what you're doing, because that's what insight is supposed to get you focused on, is what you're doing that's causing stress, what you can learn how to stop doing that's causing stress. And seeing the state of the end of stress, the end of suffering that results. We're not here trying to clone someone else's insight. We're following a path, and this is the path, looking for the stress, learning to comprehend the stress. In other words, look at whatever is coming up and understand it thoroughly to the point where you gain dispassion for it so you can stop creating it. Anything that's unnecessary, anything that's burdensome, you learn how to stop doing it. That's how you know for sure that the end of stress has come. If you're simply trying to clone what you've heard about what the path should be like, and what the result of the path should be like, it's like taking that old analogy of the road to the Grand Canyon. You look at the road to the Grand Canyon, and it doesn't look like the Grand Canyon at all. So you dig a big trench, because that's what the Grand Canyon is supposed to be. It's a big trench. So what happens is you cut off the road. You can't get there. Can't get there because you've hit the trench. You follow the path. Part of the path is developing concentration. It's not simply watching concentration come and go and say, okay, well, that concentration arises, concentration passes away, that's an insight. That's not an insight. The context of insight is not the three characteristics, it's the Four Noble Truths. The three characteristics are helpful within that context, but they don't form the context themselves. But the word three characteristics doesn't even appear in the Pali Canon. They talk about anicca as a sanya, as a perception, or as a something that you focus on as a practice. In other words, you focus on this theme so you can see what it does to the mind, particularly in the terms of how it helps you gain dispassion for things that you hold on to. The same with dukkha and anatta. It's a perception that you follow, that you try to cultivate. And then you watch to see where it is in your experience. Because of the effect that it has on your mind. It helps promote dispassion, helps promote understanding. But you're not here to get anatta. You use these things as a tool, and then you put them aside when they've done their work. So it's important that you don't let the neat distinctions drawn by scholars get in the way of your practice. And you realize that it's good to have a full range of tools available to you at all times. Because it's in the interplay of these tools, learning to get a sense of which side you need to emphasize at any one particular time, or how you can develop both together. It's in the interplay that you gain insight. This underscores the old distinction between warrior knowledge and scribe knowledge. Scribe knowledge is concerned about definitions. Samatha is one thing, vipassana is something else, jhana is one thing, discernment is something totally separate. That's the way it is in the books. And that's how scribes like their knowledge, all neat and crisp and clearly defined. But as a warrior, you've got to use whatever is available for whatever the situation that's arising. That's when you want to have all your tools available. That's when you have to have the ability to read the situation and have a sense of what's going to work and what's not going to work. And you can know this only by having all your tools ready and having experimented to see what works and what doesn't work. This is why your truthfulness is what keeps you protected as a warrior. There may be nobody out there in charge, nobody to protect you. Even though the devas protect you, there's only so much the devas can do. But you've got your own truthfulness, and that's something you can really work on. It can keep the fires away. The fires of passion, aversion, and delusion. You learn how to ward them off by being true in your meditation. And that's the only way you're going to know if what I've said just now is true. But it's good to know that that's where the truth resides. It doesn't reside in someplace else, some other person, some other outside authority. And it doesn't reside just in your own ideas of what you like and dislike. It resides in your honesty. That's why the Dharma is so special. Dishonest people can't know it. They can talk about it, but they can't really know it. Only honest and truthful people can.